Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 19th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. From the front page of today's Gazette, short life made big impact. Carson Grace remembered after battling a rare heart disorder, by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette in Washington, Iowa. For a while, she was still there. Even connected to a web of wires and tubes, her deep brown eyes projected her friendly but fierce personality. And then she wasn't. Greta and Blandon Clemens had to allow themselves to think the unthinkable. Carson Grace, their doe-eyed, seven-month-old daughter with a charming mop of black hair, wasn't going to make it. Her body was just done, Greta told the Gazette. Everything was failing at that point. But Carson's tiny body, having been diagnosed with complex congenital heart defects in the womb, including dextrocardia, when the heart develops on the right side of the chest instead of the left, had done more than most in its short time, more than many expected. I think they were kind of preparing for her not to make it right away when she came out, Greta said of Carson's birth on September 27, 2021. She was very much surprised then with how good she looked. 8 months earlier, Greta and Blandon, just over 2 years into their marriage and living in Iowa City, learned they were pregnant, and they were delighted. We got married and then wanted to have a couple of years or so, just us, Greta said, so she came at a good time. Raised in Washington, Iowa, Greta, now 30, landed at Kentucky's Morehead State University after high school, following a stop at Iowa Western Community College to play softball. Recruited to Morehead State, Greta arrived in Kentucky in 2012. Blandon, who also went to Morehead State, worked at a grocery store she frequented, so Greta saw him around and one night invited over some of his friends and he tagged along. When he came over that night, he made me take a picture of him and my roommate's cat and text it to him, Greta said, and that's how he got my phone number. The cat's name was Riley, and Blandon texted Greta right away. He wouldn't stop texting, she laughed. 5 years later, in 2017, Blandon proposed and they got married in Iowa City in August 2018. They both wanted kids, so when Greta surprised him with a positive test in January 2021, he was pretty shocked. Shocked and excited, Greta said. Stress began to creep in at their 12-week appointment when an ultrasound suggested the baby's heart was flipped. But they weren't even 100% sure if it was accurate because it was so small, Greta said. So while part of her felt scared, she and Blandon took the optimistic view that even if their baby had dextrocardia, people have that, people live with it, and it's fine. The following 16-week ultrasound, though, in May 2021, blanched their optimism. That was the one that we found out how bad it was, Greta said. An ultrasound paired with a fetal echocardiogram revealed the baby had dextrocardia and complex single ventricle congenital heart disease with unbalanced atrioventricular canal, malposed great vessels, and pulmonary atresia, along with heterotaxy. Essentially, she had severe heart defects, including one in which the valve controlling blood flow from the heart to the lungs didn't form at all. After that appointment, we both got in the car to go home and just cry, Greta said. We didn't know what to do. Crushing questions entered their minds. We also found out at that appointment that it was a girl, she said, so we were far enough along that we didn't feel like we could stop things there. We knew this was going to be a tough journey, and we really didn't know how it was going to go. Despite the grief, Carson's spirit started to charm them, to give them hope. We were still excited to meet her and start our family, Greta said. Those paradoxical feelings paralyzed Greta in what, for many pregnant women, are typically joyful and exciting rites of motherhood passage. Shopping for onesies, monitors, car seats, and plush blankets, for example, came with questions and caution. I was excited to start buying stuff, but then I also was very hesitant on buying stuff, she said. As time went on, they kind of warned us that she might not make it after birth. Once, when Greta and Blandon found themselves in Old Navy, Greta perused the baby section while Blandon tried on clothes. I remember picturing her in all the different outfits and even talking to Blandon after he was done trying on clothes, on what he would allow her to wear, she said, as a joke. I wanted to buy her an outfit so bad, but I couldn't get myself to do it. The couple skipped a baby shower, although a few close friends threw her a small surprise one, which was really nice, actually. Baby Carson did really well in Greta's womb, and both mom and baby had few complications as her due date approached. At 39 weeks and 4 days, doctors induced so Carson could be born in a controlled environment. When she came out, everybody was prepared, Greta said about her relatively easy delivery. They had told us we wouldn't be able to hold her. But Carson Grace, at 6 pounds, 10 ounces, and 19 inches long, scored a near-perfect Apgar score, a test given to infants based on their appearance, pulse, grimace reflex, activity, and respiration. So they actually did let me hold her for a little bit, Greta said. We took a couple pictures and spent probably 2 or 3 minutes. Carson, according to Greta, surprised everyone with how good she looked and how she acted. A few days later, doctors discovered why, following more echoes and tests. Carson's developing body had created tiny arteries to do the job her missing heart valve was supposed to do. They're basically in place of the pulmonary arteries, Greta said. They're just really thin little tube-like things that connect together to mimic the pulmonary artery to pass the blood to the lungs, the body, the heart. Carson's strong start upended doctors' post-birth plan. She still needed surgeries to correct the complex problems, but for a while, Carson got to go home with her mommy and daddy and live a mostly normal baby existence. We had to give her medicine and she had a feeding tube, Greta said. Those were the only baby things that normally you wouldn't have. In her crib next to a wall hanging that read, "She has fire in her soul and grace in her heart," Carson spent months of peaceful nights under the watchful eye of her parents and the baby monitor they weren't sure they would need. She posed for newborn photos with her eyes wide open. She took naps with one fist balled up by her cheek and one arm straight in the air. She liked her pacifier and also her fingers. She stared in wonder at the family cats, Tim and Tegan, who stared right back. Carson, with her laughs and her cries and her bouncing in the frog-style jumper, was a dream realized, Greta said, reminiscing about the day at the mall months earlier. That day in Old Navy was hard, she said. We were so excited and had fun picturing her in outfits, but it also hit home that we may never see her in any of these type of clothes. I'm so happy we were able to, Greta said. And after she was born, I remember making a pretty large purchase from Old Navy, including her denim jacket. Around November, Carson began experiencing breathing difficulty and ended up at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital again, where they began to discuss surgeries doctors said she'd need for a shot at long-term survival. Due to the specialized nature of the procedures, UIH physicians sent Carson's case to Stanford Healthcare in Palo Alto, California, to see what they'd say. They may say they can't do anything, Greta said. They may say they can. In December, Stanford accepted Carson's case and the family began planning a trip to California. They arrived in March for a series of procedures and surgeries they expected could keep them there 6 to 8 weeks, a journey Greta's mom, Krista Smines, would catalog on social media for a growing thousands of praying friends and family. Before getting on the plane, Smines wrote about the unknowns. I would be lying if I said we are not really scared and second-guessing everything, especially since Carson seems so normal in a lot of ways, she wrote March 10th, but noted the ideal time to operate is when she's doing well, not when she's sick. Carson underwent her first operation in Palo Alto on March 18th, with a plan for more intensive surgeries in the days to come, including one March 22nd that lasted 23 hours. Although that surgery went well, doctors discovered during the procedure that Carson had a heart rhythm abnormality. That caused her to code after the surgery, Greta said. Carson recovered and was intubated on a breathing tube. She also had to go on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, as life support so her heart and lungs could recover. Through clear dressing on her open chest, her family watched Carson's heart beating, and after about a week, Carson successfully went off ECMO. The breathing tube was harder, according to Greta. They tried 2 different times to get her off of it, and they couldn't. She just wasn't handling it, Greta said. More tests showed Carson's pulmonary veins were closing, requiring another surgery, and Carson's body was unable to recover. Her body was struggling to clot blood and also support blood flow to vital organs. It was just not good, Greta said. She underwent 2 major surgeries in 2 weeks, and her body was basically shutting down. Friends and family and people she never met flooded Facebook with prayers and images of lit candles. Although Carson spent a lot of time sedated, with her long dark eyelashes touching her cheeks, she fought to watch her mom and dad engage with them, even flashing smiles through gauze and tubes and wires. When Greta and Blandon are in the room, she wants to constantly track them and make eye contact and gets a bit too riled up with her big leg kicks, Smines wrote April 5th on Facebook. Although mom and dad couldn't hold her, Blandon did a lot of singing. "Good afternoon, Miss Carson," he sang in one video. "We sing to you, Miss Carson." She also heard a lot of books and a lot of I love yous. And on May 7th, Siemens wrote, Mother's Day came early to Lucille Packard Children's Hospital, and we will be forever grateful to the wonderful group of professionals who made it happen. It has been nearly 7 weeks since Greta and Blandon have held Carson, she wrote in a Facebook post. Today, they were able to hold her for literally hours as her numbers were excellent while being held. They snapped a family picture, even as Smines wrote, "We are not sure what going forward will look like." 3 days later, Greta and Blandon made the impossible decision to let their daughter go. There is always hope, especially when looking at her, but there is a point, and probably a lot of parents don't have to experience this, but you can just tell, you just don't want to put them through it anymore, Greta said. The doctors closed up Carson's chest as her body couldn't keep up with her will. And eventually, Mom and Dad carried her to an outdoor patio where they covered her in kisses and waited. It was just us, a nurse, and a doctor that were out there, Greta said. It was very peaceful. The couple returned to Iowa days later with broken hearts. They were met by a massive network of friends and family who had prayed over their daughter, who didn't make it as far as they'd hoped, but farther than anyone expected. A month later, on a warm evening in June, Greta and Blandon served themselves pork for dinner from among the pans and Tupperware of food delivered in the weeks after Carson's death. And they talked about her legacy. They talked about their future. "I think she will live on for a really long time," Greta said. "I think she made more of an impact than a lot of people do in a lifetime." Both Greta and Blandon hope to have other kids. Testing showed Carson's issues weren't the result of any genetic abnormality. But for now, they buried her ashes in a cemetery by their home in Washington, reserving spots for themselves next to her. Across the small pond behind their house, they planted a tree next to a bench next to a plaque of Carson. Next month, the couple has more intimate memorial plans, using some of her ashes to ink tattoos of her birthday on their wrists. "We know she was really sick, and we know she's in a better place now," Greta said. "But we miss her very much." Also from the front page, African American Museum plans $5 million renovation. By Elijah Decius of the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. A $5 million renovation project, prompted by construction of the city's flood control system, will change the face of Iowa's only African American museum as it launches a vision for bigger statewide presence. The African American Museum of Iowa's front entrance, which will be blocked by the planned floodgate along 12th Avenue Southeast, will be moved to the building's east side. A $1.7 million contribution from the city of Cedar Rapids will help cover the entrance relocation, impacted exterior landscaping, an upgraded lobby space, and updated parking lot at 55 12th Avenue Southeast. But in its biggest campaign since it moved to its current building in 2003, the new museum will be taking the project a few steps further to address long-needed fixes and upgrades. "Now is the time to make our statewide vision tangible," Executive Director Lanisha Castle said. "I do see that we have an opportunity to have a statewide presence, and the current building does not reflect what most people envision for a museum that should have that kind of draw. The museum is working to capitalize on the opportunity to make its biggest upgrades and expansions in 19 years as the physical barriers are installed along the Cedar River. Major fixes for and upgrades to a leaky roof, the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system, plumbing, and other functional necessities have been eyed for several years." With sustained demand for African-American education that spiked after the murder of George Floyd in 2020 in Minneapolis, Castle said the museum has become more of a platform for programming, a shift away from being just a repository of history. "National protest after George Floyd's murder ramped up people's willingness and desire to do something they hadn't done before," she said, "not only self-educating, but asking, how can I be an ally?" As the museum makes good on the operative words in its name, of Iowa, Castle anticipates that revamped travel exhibits will draw new audiences to the museum's home in Cedar Rapids. "The physical building itself is going to be huge. It's going to be more welcoming and inviting," she said. "We're going to fit in better with the landscape of the community." The Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, Wright Brothers Fast Track. The Iowa Transportation Commission on Wednesday approved the draft of a 5-year, $4.2 billion transportation plan that accelerates work on Wright Brothers Boulevard in Cedar Rapids. The plan also will reconfigure the Interstate 380 and Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest Interchange, giving a major boost to a fast-growing part of the city that has become host to massive industrial developments. "We are extremely pleased that this particular interchange really is going to be built in record time," City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said. "This is a very important strategic area as far as job creation in Cedar Rapids." Federal funding for safer schools. Iowa school districts will have access to more resources designed to help prevent school violence, thanks to $100 million in federal pandemic relief funding that Governor Kim Reynolds is putting into the state's School Safety Bureau. Reynolds created the School Safety Bureau in January 2020, but the Republican-majority Iowa legislature has not funded the Bureau in the three legislative sessions since. The money will go for personnel, training, and emergency communication systems to help schools prevent school violence or react to emergency events like a school shooting. Tuition headed up. Tuition likely will go up 4.25% for Iowans attending one of the state's three public universities this fall. The Board of Regents will first consider the increase Wednesday before taking a final vote in July. A $355 bump at the University of Iowa would increase total base tuition for the year from $8,356 to $8,711. A $345 increase at Iowa State University would bring the total to $8,678, and a $331 increase at the University of Northern Iowa would put the total at $8,111. Jobless benefits cut. Unemployed workers in Iowa will be eligible to receive state unemployment benefits for 10 fewer weeks under legislation signed into law Thursday by Governor Kim Reynolds. The new law reduces the length of state unemployment benefits from 26 weeks to 16. Iowa becomes the fourth state with 16 weeks or fewer of state unemployment benefits. Reynolds on Thursday also signed into law legislation that allows 16 and 17-year-olds to work unsupervised at child care centers. Under the heading, They Said, I do go to school wondering if it will be my last day or if I should have said I love you to my dad or my mom. Peter Brozine, 14, Iowa City High freshman who helped organize a Monday protest in Iowa City against gun violence. And every family should be able to confidently send their children to school knowing that they will be safe. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds in announcing she'll direct $100 million in federal pandemic relief funds to the state's School Safety Bureau. Under the heading Odds and Ends, costumes for sale. About 6,000 costumes, many of them handmade, are for sale at the Balloons Etc. and the Costume Emporium, 420 2nd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Owners Jacob and Kimberly Cowger said they were downsizing after being unable to find enough staff to repair the costumes. No vax rule at school. Iowa colleges, K-12 school districts, and daycare centers cannot require students and children to be immunized from COVID-19 under legislation signed into law Tuesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. Under the heading The Water Cooler, Gatens is back. Matt Gatens says it's pretty special and cool to rejoin the Iowa Hawkeyes as an assistant basketball coach under Fran McCaffrey. Gatens, an Iowa City native, was a terrific player at UI, 1,635 points, from 2009 to 2012, and was on McCaffrey's first two Iowa teams. Love story. Dwayne Mann, a sailor, was stationed in Japan in 1953 during the Korean War. He fell in love with Peggy Yamaguchi. He was ordered to return to Iowa by the Navy, where he expected to send for Peggy. But it was not to be for a variety of reasons. Both Mann and Peggy married other people and had children, but it bothered Mann for almost seven decades that Peggy might think he'd abandon her. Thanks to some internet sleuthing, Mann, now 91 and living in Woodbine in western Iowa, recently was able to visit Peggy in Michigan, where she'd settled with her Air Force husband. Making scratch. An Eldridge man won $100,000 on an Iowa Lottery Supreme scratch ticket. He bought the ticket at a convenience store in Nevada, Iowa, while traveling across the state. And in the heading More in the News, BlockFi blocked. BlockFi Lending must pay $943,396 and stop making untrue statements regarding securities, according to an agreement reached with Iowa insurance regulators. Regulators said the lending company was selling securities not permitted for sale in Iowa without being registered as an agent in the state. Bringing home the bacon. Wisconsin-based meat processing company Fair Oaks Foods plans to build a $134 million facility in Davenport to make bacon. The 150,000-square-foot facility will be near Interstate 80. It's expected to create about 247 new full-time jobs with an average hourly wage of $23.95. An ex-cop pleads guilty. A former Davenport and Eldridge police officer pleaded guilty to sex abuse charges involving a 14-year-old girl during a hearing Tuesday in Scott County District Court. Andrew Patrick DeNoyer, 24, pleaded guilty to three counts of third-degree sexual abuse. Turning to the Insight column and a guest column from Jim Brown, Young Parents Network Dads Group facilitator and board member. Father's Day. Big shoes bring a bigger reward for young fathers. There are multiple theories about the origins of American Father's Day. It is most frequently put forth that, in 1910, Mrs. Sonora Smart Dodd of Spokane, Washington, created a day to honor her father, who raised her and her five siblings as a single parent. In 1924, President Calvin Coolidge recommended the day become a national holiday. In 1966, President Lyndon Johnson declared that the celebration be held on the third Sunday in June. And in 1972, President Richard Nixon made Father's Day a national holiday. CJ is a single father who attended over 200 YPN Dads Group meetings over a six-year period because he wanted to be the best father he could be. He almost never missed. During that time, he fought first for his visitation rights and then his custody rights until he was granted full custody of his toddler son. His YPN friends supported him through the entire struggle. YPN encourages literacy and the important role reading to your children plays in their brain development. CJ took that message to heart, but struggled with reading, so he went to the library and checked out children's books with accompanying CDs. Instead of playing the CDs, he memorized them. He then put his son on his lap and read to him. That boy is now in middle school. I am proud of CJ for his commitment to his child and his role as the coolest guy in his son's whole world. YPN was founded as Young Parents Network in 1985 by community leaders who saw the need to support young families. As the organization developed, the need for father-specific programming was identified. Thus, Dad's Group was created. This was a unique concept at the time. Dads at YPN know that in the eyes of their children, they are the coolest guy in the whole world, and that their job is to live up to that expectation. They know that by being actively involved in their kids' lives, they are increasing the chances that the child will succeed in school and is less likely to drop out. Paternal involvement also decreases offspring drug usage, criminal activity, teen pregnancy, and suicide. 40 weeks each year, men meet with the goal of becoming the best fathers they can be. They face different challenges. Some, like CJ, are involved in legal battles to get more time with their kids. Others want to know how to deal with crying babies or rebellious three-year-olds. YPN offers them research-based parenting curricula like 24/7 Dad and Love and Logic, but it's their own interaction with each other that has the greatest impact. Here's what I did when my son did that, or this really helped my daughter. We discuss topics like literacy, fun with your kids, household safety, men's health, discipline, and whatever might be troubling a particular dad. They receive a menu of positive parenting behaviors for which they can earn points that can be spent at the YPN We Care shop on items like diapers, baby clothes, and children's books. As a YPN volunteer for over 14 years, I've seen firsthand the wonderful work the organization does for so many parents. I am proud and impacted by all of them. And that was Jim Brown, YPN Dad's Group facilitator and board member. Brown is a husband, father, and grandfather, and the founder of Wrestling for Life, a nonprofit offering access to wrestling equipment, tickets to meets, and camp scholarships to student wrestlers. And Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Dorman, Reynolds Education Pitch, Drag Shows, and Pornographic Books. Maybe you missed it, but Governor Kim Reynolds launched her fall re-election campaign at the Republican Party of Iowa State Convention last weekend. She struck a positive tone in her assessment of Iowa public schools. Yeah, she really didn't. Not even close. Drag shows for young kids, pornographic books in school libraries, elementary school lessons on pronouns, and sadly, the list goes on, Reynolds told the convention. This has to stop. Ultimately, we're going to make sure that every parent has a choice in their child's education, Reynolds said. Rather than pitch her plan to provide $55 million in public education funds for private school vouchers by touting any educational merits, the governor once again portrayed it as an escape hatch for kids to flee porn-ridden dens of iniquity. Transgender students are a threat. Books are a threat. Heck, the notion of a nation unafraid to face its history that cherishes free expression and protects civil rights is a threat. This has to stop, the governor says. A couple of days later, Democratic gubernatorial nominee Deidre DeGeer stopped in Cedar Rapids on her Reynolds report card tour. She doesn't think much of Reynolds' school choice voucher plan, which would provide bucks to 10,000 students while taking money away from schools that serve 485,000. 100% of our students need the undivided attention of our governor in order to improve their opportunity within the education system, DeGeer said, according to the Gazette's Tom Barton. Are we willing to fight for that common ground, DeGeer said, to be real? To talk about the real issues that Iowans are facing, not the ones that people want to use to divide us, like what bathroom somebody goes to. Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman offered his typical measured response, nuanced response to DeGeer's report card tour. DeGeer, who has received the endorsement of tyrannical teacher unions, will never stand up for our state students or their parents. To DeGere, teacher unions are in control, not Iowans. That's not the kind of educational policy Iowans want out of their governor, Kaufman said in a statement likely transcribed from a bullhorn. Kaufman praised Reynolds' education record, including her use of executive edicts seizing local control from school districts during the pandemic, banning mask requirements, and defending parents' rights, including the ones who have dabbled in QAnon while portraying mask rules as child abuse. He didn't mention the 2.5% increase in public school funding, trailing record inflation, while the state sits on a big surplus and hands out tax cuts benefiting the wealthiest Iowans. That's quite a public education record. Governor Reynolds is the only candidate running for governor who will defend freedom, the voices of parents, and who will fight for your family's safety, your future, and your hard-earned paycheck, Kaufman crowed. Don't buy into their version of freedom. Your choice is to get lost. How about a plan to improve public schools? Nah, they're a lost cause, full of lib indoctrination and litter boxes and those tyrannical teachers' unions. Never mind that in 2017, the Republican legislature shredded collective bargaining rights for public school teachers and staff in retaliation for union support of Democrats. The GOP has lowballed school funding increases since they took over the state house. And of course, the Republican president of the Iowa Senate says educators have a sinister agenda to harm kids. The teaching ranks are riddled with groomers, socialists, and porn peddlers. We need to yank away already scarce resources from public schools and hand the dollars over to private schools, where no indoctrination happens ever. Many schools, rural and urban, are struggling, and we have a crisis-level teacher shortage, clearly the fault of tyrannical unions. Whenever these issues come up, I think of my parents. Both were public school teachers. My mom taught kindergarten in the 50s and 60s in Iowa. My dad taught science at a small, rural school and eventually became a guidance counselor at my hometown high school. He also coached and taught driver's education for decades. He used to tell me stories of the good old days before tyrannical teachers' unions gained clout at the bargaining table. Before that, we had tyrannical administrators who could fire teachers for just about any reason they could dream up. We had school boards packed with frugal farmers who saw no reason to give teachers raises. Good times. It wasn't until 1972 that the Iowa State Education Association won a court ruling barring districts from forcing pregnant teachers to resign. It was upheld by the Iowa Supreme Court in 1975. Collective bargaining came in 1974. My dad left for school early and usually got home late after basketball practice, working a track meet or some other after-school duty. In the summer, he'd rise even earlier to teach driver's ed in the morning and would come home late after a softball game on the road. He and my mother went above and beyond for the kids who needed them. It's impossible to list all the ways. This is my first Father's Day without my dad. His work makes me proud. So when I hear Reynolds reduce all the hard work educators do to cruel soundbites, the sacrifices they make and the advocacy they pursue on behalf of students, it's beyond maddening. It's outrageous and responsible at a time when some Americans believe violence is legitimate political discourse. The government should be ashamed. Of course she's not. Not even close. And turning to the community letters and today's editorial cartoon from Joe Heller of Green Bay, a family of three and their dog, their shadows long in front of them, look away, or look at us from the panel. Mom says, "That supermoon was so cool." Meanwhile, Dad has sweat lines coming off of him as a giant sun rises in the horizon behind them and says, "June heat wave." The first letter is from Keith Berg of Marion. Look at validity of school arrests. There is an important piece of information missing when discussing the disparity in arrests in the schools by the police. What percentage of the arrests were warranted or valid? For example, if a large percentage of the arrests were found to be wrong or that the person did not commit the infraction or crime for which they were arrested, then you would focus attention on changing the arrest process, the types of infractions police are involved, or the police officer. If, however, you find that the percentage of arrests are valid and the person actually did commit the infraction or crime, then the fault is not with the police officer and their arrest process, but the person's actually committing the crime or infraction. So what percentage of the arrests were valid? Where the infractions or crimes were actually committed by the person being charged? Answer that question, and you can focus attention on where the problem lies in the disparity of arrests, the police or the people being charged. Can someone provide that data to this discussion? Keith Berg of Marion. Next, Sonia Ettinger of Iowa City writes, "Senators not listening to the public on guns." 19 Uvalde, Texas children were murdered by an 18-year-old who used a military-style assault weapon. Two children were decapitated, their bodies pulverized, according to the pediatrician called in to identify and certify their deaths. If this is not enough to move our senators to tears and to action, then what is? These guns are not necessary for hunting. They pulverize tissue. Is campaign support from the NRA more important than protecting our children and grandchildren? Our senators are not representing the public. A vast majority of the people would accept, at the very least, a higher age at which one could buy such weapons. Some years ago, we had a nationwide ban on all assault weapons. It was allowed to lapse, with the predictable result. It behooves all of those who care about this country's children to vote for those representatives who have the fortitude to vote as if they have a conscience. Sonia Ettinger of Iowa City. Next, Monty Whitlock of Solon writes, billions wasted while real solutions ignored. It's now a rush for city, state, and federal governments to spend millions and even billions of dollars for new school safety. We will see any manner of new ideas to spend the money on new counselors, happiness programs, and new committees to come up with more new ideas, all of which will have little impact but to score political points and say we did something. Everyone pats themselves on the back until it happens again. Time to face the facts. You can rarely stop deranged people. They are not troubled. They have fallen into insanity. Only insane people would slaughter little children trapped in a room. They will find a way to do what they want to do, but you can defend against large-scale carnage in confined areas. If you truly want to save children, you will reinstate officers in the schools. Stop coddling troublemakers. I would bet on veterans to help do the job. One cop and one veteran, both armed in schools. Train and arm teachers who would agree, and most obvious of all, for those billions, install one-way exit doors or egress windows in classrooms. The holes are already there. It doesn't take a committee to figure out a practical solution. How many doors can you install for $1 billion? While another new committee sits around wringing its hands trying to figure out what to do. Monty Whitlock of Solon. Next, Jackie McTaggart of Independence writes, teachers must not be armed at school. Although everyone would like to see the senseless, horrific gun violence in schools stopped, thus far we have been unable to reach consensus as to how to go about doing it. I don't pretend to have the answers, but I do know one thing. Arming teachers, as Ohio voted to do on June 13th, is not the answer. If a teacher or any school employee is going to use a gun to thwart an intruder and protect her students, she will need to have the weapon loaded and on her person or within reach at all times. Does anyone really think this is a good idea? What about the curious primary child who innocently pulls the weapon out of the teacher's holster just to see what it looks, feels, or sounds like? Or how about the older student who comes unhinged because his girlfriend gave him the boot? A teacher must never have a gun within the school setting, not even in a locked drawer or cupboard. A loaded gun is far too risky, and an unloaded one stuffed in a special hiding spot is useless. Iowans may not agree on what we should do to solve school shootings, but I sincerely hope we can agree on what not to do. Jackie McTaggart of Independence. And Jim Walters of Iowa City writes, vote Grassley out to protect school safety. In 2 months, my only grandchild will start kindergarten. The thought that some deranged loser could legally buy a military-style assault rifle, body armor, hundreds of rounds of ammunition, post his intentions on social media, and then enter her school, kill her, her classmates, and teachers, is completely unacceptable to me. Our senior Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley says there's little to be done about this. I disagree. Iowa's parents and grandparents can vote him out of office and replace him with someone who will actually work to protect the safety of our children. Jim Walters of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 19th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Network. I am your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn to today's obituaries. In the other notices, Charles L. Noke, N-O-K-E, 82, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, June 17th, Papich Cuba Funeral Home east of Cedar Rapids. And of Marion, Kent Baker, age 78, died Thursday, June 16th, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion, handling arrangements. Harlan Westerholm, 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed away at home on Saturday, June 11th. A memorial will be scheduled at a later date. Harlan served in the U.S. Air Force from 1951 to 1955. He liked to hunt and fish. He also enjoyed spending time with his family and watching Western movies. Chris Lewis, 72, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, May 13th, 2022. A visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, June 25th, at Calvary Baptist Church, 5338 Johnson Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 11 a.m. on Saturday at the church. Gary Williams, age 83, of Cedar Rapids, passed away at Hallmar of Mercy on Tuesday, June 14th, surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Wednesday, June 22nd, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. A funeral service will be held at 4 p.m. Wednesday, June 22nd, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories, with Pastor Julie Wenner officiating. Gary coached many sports at Cedar Rapids, Kennedy, and Cedar Rapids, Washington. He was coach of the 1979 Iowa State Championship girls volleyball team. After Kennedy and Washington, Gary continued to coach at Coe College, where he won a conference title. He was voted the most popular teacher several times from the students at Kennedy High School. He's a member of the Iowa Coaching Hall of Fame, as well as the Iowa Teachers Union. Gary was a longtime teacher in the Cedar Rapids public school system. He was a member of St. Paul's UMC for many years. Gary was an avid fisherman, hunter, and beloved family man. He made everyone feel important. Richard G. Wessels, known as Dick, age 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully Monday, June 13th, at his home after a short and courageous battle with cancer. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 21st, at Cedar Memorial. Celebration of life to follow the visitation at the Time Out Lounge. Dick's career was spent as a supervisor at Alice Chalmers, P&H Harnischweger, Rockwell Goss, and Metro Harley-Davidson. A man of few words, the leader Dick was truly one of a kind that drew so many people to him. His passions include riding his Harley, cards and horse racing, love for sports, fishing, golfing, and having a beer with friends and family. John Edward Holmquist, 63, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, June 15, at his home due to natural causes. A ceremony in John's honor will be held at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. John had worked as a retail manager in several states and retired from Whirlpool. He loved to read and enjoyed watching college basketball and sci-fi movies. Roger A. Oberfell, 55, of Cedar Rapids, passed away from lung cancer on Thursday, June 16th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, June 20th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will take place at 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 21st, at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Simply said, Roger was a great human being. He was kind, devoted, funny, hardworking, giving, humble, faith-filled, and a friend to all. He positively impacted everyone's lives. He enjoyed biking, spending time with his kids, card games, fishing, weightlifting, trivia, walking his dogs, mowing his lawn, bird watching, and had a love of desserts. Robert William Barrage, 87, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Monday, June 13th, at his home. The family will greet friends and family from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 24th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 25th, at the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection, 3500 29th Avenue, Marion, where additional visitation will take place 1 hour prior to the service. Robert was in the U.S. Army and served as a corporal from 1952 to 1955. He was a veteran of the Korean War. Robert returned to Western Electric after his U.S. Army service and then to Collins Rockwell International, where he worked for 33 years as a radio technician. He was active in the Marion Legion Post 298, joining in 1974, and serving in numerous leadership roles, culminating as 2nd District Commander. Lester Hicks, 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on December 22, 2020. Family and friends are invited to his celebration of life at 1 p.m. Saturday, June 25th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service, Cedar Rapids, by celebrant Don Stevens. Interment and military honors will be at 11 a.m. Monday, June 27th, at Czech National Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Salvador Fregoso, known as Ray, age 54, an luminous stream of concentrated energy emerging forward, piercing through shades of darkness in a persistent path of never-ending guiding light, died January 1st, 2022. Graveside service, 2:30 p.m. Wednesday, June 22nd, at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service of Cedar Rapids is caring for Ray's family. Ray shared real life on the real shining light on what it's like to be human. He solidified the role of hero, making all the resounding difference. Ray showed us how to survive a poorly dealt hand and still have courage to seek profit. Just as if concealed by the sleeve, the royal is always kept within. Judith Latner Dowse, known as Judy of Cedar Rapids, who was born March 27, 1930, passed away on an unspecified date. Judy always remembered with fondness her years teaching at Tyler Elementary, Adams Elementary, and Coe College, as well as her many wonderful students. Judy loved playing viola in the Cedar Rapids Symphony and volunteered with several local organizations. A memorial gathering for Judy will be held at a later date. Blake Edward Benson, age 52, died Tuesday, May 31st at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha, following a courageous battle with cancer. A celebration of Blake's life will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday, June 25th, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. Interment will be held at Maplewood Cemetery in Vinton. Blake worked as a carpenter prior to his illness. He enjoyed NASCAR, watched the beginning, take a nap, and wait to see the finish. He enjoyed watching basketball and football and was a Tennessee Titan fan. He was a Ford man and enjoyed working on cars and was a skilled handyman, playing softball, bowling, and spending time with his friends and beloved four-legged friend, Sammy, were also his favorite pastimes. He also loved to travel to Colorado. A celebration of life will be held for Dwayne and John Lidai on June 25th at IBEW Local 405 from 1 to 3 p.m. The address is 1211 Wiley Boulevard Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Refreshments and cookies will be served. Dwayne Lidai, 82, died of natural causes on January 2, 2022 in Clearwater, Florida. And John William Lidai, 52, of Goodyear, Arizona, passed away April 20th, 2022 from complications of a stroke. Denise E. Martinson, age 58, of Williamsburg, passed away Tuesday, June 14th at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, June 23rd at Trinity Lutheran Church in Conroy. The Reverend Gary Sears will be officiating. The family will receive friends from 9:30 a.m. until service time at Trinity Lutheran Church, Conroy. Interment will be in the First Lutheran Church Cemetery, rural Conroy. A memorial fund has been established. Kloster Funeral Home of Marengo is assisting the family. Denise was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church of Conroy. She worked at Williamsburg Manufacturing for 23 years as a press operator, a tool crib attendant, and a painter in the painting booth. Denise loved to play jokes and was fluent in sarcasm, all in good fun. She enjoyed her time at home, talking and playing games on her phone, and playing on her computer, and spending time with her dogs. Marjorie Lucille Firehelm, 92, of Shellsburg, died Thursday, June 16th at her home. Services, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday at Oak Grove Church in Shellsburg by Pastor Matt McGee. Burial, Dunham Grove Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the church, and at the church on Wednesday after 9:30 a.m., Van Steenhouse Tea and Funeral Home is serving the family. Marjorie's favorite job was being a wife, mom, and grandmother, but she also worked outside of the home at Chamberlain Manufacturing, Waterloo Community Schools, Kirkwood Cafeteria, Donut Land, and Tasty Freeze. Marge enjoyed baking pies, cookies, brownies, cookies, cakes, and fluffy tapioca pudding for family dinners and parties. She shared her baked goodies with her Sunday school classes and many others. Marge loved watching the wildlife, feeding the birds, beautiful flowers, shopping, traveling, and socializing with her friends and neighbors who meant so much to her. Kenneth Eugene Warren, age 82, known as Mooney of Iowa City, formerly of Marion, passed away on Saturday, January 29, 2022, at his home following a lengthy illness. A graveside service with full military honors will be held at 2 p.m. on Saturday, June 25th, at Lisbon Cemetery in Lisbon. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Jane Elizabeth Ammon, age 80, of Iowa City, died Monday, May 30th at the Birdhouse Hospice Home in Johnson County. Memorial services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 25th at Zion Lutheran Church, Iowa City, with Pastor Jennifer Lutz officiating. Private family interment, St. John's Lutheran Church Cemetery in rural Monticello. John Henry Bailey, age 77, of Marion, left this world suddenly due to COVID-19-related heart attack on January 16, 2022, in Mission, Texas. John had been an avid bicyclist doing RagBrite 20-plus years. He loved to camp, kayak, canoe, garage sale, and read magazines, his iPad, or anything he could get his hands on. Service will be at noon at the Woodpecker Lodge at Pinnacon Ridge in Central City, held by Pastor Jeff Froner, following by a celebration of life and luncheon until 4 p.m. James Carl Geringer, known as Jim of Williamsburg, was born on July 4, 1936, and has passed away. He worked as a milk truck driver. He drove for Hummer Trucking, worked at Iowa County Department in 1974, went to work at the county home or Hillside Estates. He enjoyed playing cards, gambling, any Hawkeye sports, and especially enjoyed watching his grandchildren and great-grandchildren in their activities. He died on Wednesday, June 15th, at the English Valley Care Center in North English at the age of 85. Celebration of Life service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, June 21st, at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. Burial will be in the Yankee Point Cemetery near Parnell. Visitation will be on Monday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. James Luters, known as Jim, age 72, of Deming, Arizona, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died September 2, 2021, in Phoenix. Services, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 25th, at Emmanuel Baptist Church by Pastor Dan Wiersema. Burial, Oakland Cemetery in Solon. Tian Funeral Home is serving the family. Claire G. Roush, a World War II Marine Corps combat veteran who served in the Pacific Theater, passed away at his home on May 6, 2022. He was a longtime science educator at West High School in Iowa City. Claire loved everything outdoors, especially hunting and fishing. He was a lifelong naturalist and could identify almost every plant or animal he came across, and during his lifetime, he planted thousands of trees in Iowa. Claire made numerous trips to Alaska, hunting and fishing with his brother and his sons. Claire's wishes were to continue his love of science and education by gifting his body to the University of Iowa's Deeded Body Program. There will be no funeral or religious service per his wishes. A memorial service for family and friends will be held later this summer. Finnegan Reed Bunnell of Adel was born sleeping Tuesday, June 7th at 11:32 p.m. He weighed 3 pounds, 15.8 ounces, 16.5 inches long with red hair, and he was perfect in every way. He is our true Irish angel. He will be greatly missed and forever remembered by his loving parents, Dakota Bunnell and Kara Egan, grandparents David and Tasha Egan, and Gary and Ellen Bunnell, his two fur siblings at home, Chip and Bella, along with his Auntie Emma, great-grandparents, many cousins and other aunts and uncles. Tooraloo-raloo-ral, goodbye, I'll be seeing you, our sweet boy. There will be no services. Doris Jean Moore, age 90, of Montmody, Minnesota, passed away on Friday, June 10th. Doris worked for many years as an accountant at several different businesses. She loved bus trips to the casino, including hosting the trips and traveling around the United States. In respecting Doris' wishes, no formal service will be held. A celebration of life for Jacqueline M. Hempstead, born Jacqueline M. Pulver, will be held from 2 to 3:30 p.m. Sunday, June 26th at the Delhi Methodist Church in Delhi, Iowa, with Pastor Keith Pitts officiating. Jacqueline was born August 30th, 1939, and passed away on Sunday, May 22nd at home, surrounded by her family. Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service assisted the family. The family of Bob Hay will be hosting a Celebration of Life open house from 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. June 25th at Christ Community Church, 3000 Alburnett Road in Marion, with a brief service at 2 p.m. In addition to the Celebration of Life, there will be a blood drive to save time at the same time in Bob's honor. Beverly Ann Weltha, born Beverly Ann Borwick, age 86, of Marion, passed away on Thursday, June 16th. A private family interment will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Beverly was at home raising her family and doing volunteer church work until accepting a position as a receptionist at First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids, which she held until retirement. Beverly was an active charter member of Ascension Lutheran Church. She enjoyed singing, her family, grandkids, great-grandkids, and in-laws. Lee Alexandra Schilling, beloved daughter of Everett Schilling of rural Alburnett, passed away on June 6, 2022 in a Denver hospital at the age of 30. Lee graduated from Air Force Academy in high school in Colorado Springs in 2010. She worked for Blue Star Recycling and was a dog sitter. Dogs and cats were the love of her life. Lee had an infectious smile, beautiful blue eyes, caring personality, and a generous heart. Her hands were seldom idle. If she wasn't knitting a thoughtful creation for someone, she was making thoughtful cards, never missing a holiday. Lee's other loves included the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Family and friends are invited to a gathering at the home of Lee's dad in rural Alburnett on Sunday, June 26, from noon to 2 p.m. in remembrance of Lee. And John Franklin Locher of Cedar Rapids passed away from Lewy body dementia on Thursday, June 16, in his home with his family by his side. As a lawyer, John was honest, fair, and respected. His greatest satisfaction as an attorney was his work with adoptions. John will be remembered for his kindness, his sense of humor, his generosity, his commitment to social justice, his competitiveness, and his fierce loyalty to his family. Visitation 1 to 3 p.m. Monday, June 20th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Funeral service 3 p.m. Monday, June 20th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Turning to the sports section, Title IX, 50 years, 50 moments in Iowa women's athletic history. Iowa Field Hockey's first Final Four in 1984. By John Stepp of the Gazette. Judith Davidson experienced some joy in November 1984 in Chicago. Iowa Field Hockey head coach and her team's departure was delayed, so the airline issued free tickets. That was just in time for Iowa's upcoming foreign trip to England. Thank God, Davidson remembers thinking, fundraising is over. The far bigger joy for the Hawkeyes, though, involved where they were going once the flight finally took off, the Final Four. Along with it being Iowa Field Hockey's first Final Four, it was the closest any Hawkeye women's team had been to a national championship at that time. It was exciting for sure, Davidson told the Gazette. That's what you work for. That's what you try to build toward. After falling one game short of a Final Four bid in 1982 and 1983, the Hawkeyes broke through in 1984 with a 2-0 win over Northwestern, the team that had spoiled Iowa's postseason hopes the year before. Iowa shut out Temple 2-0 in the semifinals despite three straight Temple penalty corners to advance to its first national championship game. Our defense was like a brick wall, Davidson said to the Daily Iowan after the game. The Hawkeyes had their hands full the next day with their national championship opponent, Old Dominion, though. An Iowa team that had never been on this stage before was about to face off against the reigning back-to-back NCAA champions. At the time, Old Dominion had several international players on their team, Davidson told the Gazette. They were very, very good, no question about it. Iowa hung with the uber-talented Old Dominion for a while, going into halftime knotted at 1-1. I'm thinking that must have made them really mad, Davidson said. That's because of what happened in the second half. ODU scored four unanswered goals, handing Iowa a 5-1 loss in the national championship game. ODU finished the game with a 35-11 advantage in shots on goal. They were the better team, Davidson said. While the 1984 trip ended with a loss, it was the beginning of a stretch between Davidson and next head coach Beth Biglin of sustained postseason success. From 1984 to 1999, Iowa went to 10 Final Fours. And finally today, in the Time Machine section, a look back at people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. A king visits Decorah. Olav and his family developed a soft spot for city's Norwegian heritage. By Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. King Olav V of Norway visited Iowa as king in May 1968, but he was already familiar with the state. He and his wife, Crown Princess Martha, had visited Decorah in May 1939 when he was the crown prince. The royal couple were on an extensive tour of the United States, and Decorah, with its deep Norwegian heritage, was their only Iowa stop. Luther College conferred an honorary Doctor of Law degree on the prince, and the Hotel Winnesheek remodeled three rooms and two bathrooms on its first floor into a suite for the royal couple's overnight stay. When the Nazis invaded Norway in 1940, Princess Martha and her three children left the country and stayed in Washington, D.C. as guests of President Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, while the prince stayed in England. The family reunited in Norway after the war. The prince became King Olav V in September 1957, following the death of his father, King Haakon VII. Olav and Martha's son, Crown Prince Harald, visited Decorah in October 1965, where he also received an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from Luther College. The two-hour visit was packed with speeches and a tour of the three-story Norwegian-American Museum. The prince was tanned and fit following his win of a sailing championship the previous month. He also was a member of Norway's Olympic sailing team in Tokyo. In the 1968 visit, King Olav became the first reigning Norwegian monarch to visit Iowa during a whirlwind tour that also included stops in Texas, Los Angeles, and New Orleans. The king's plane arrived at the Decorah Airport on May 4th, a cloudy, cool day that threatened rain. It was one of about 20 planes to land that day, making it one of the busiest days ever at the airport. The king was greeted by hundreds of children, many in Norwegian dress, who lined the route from the airport to downtown Decorah and to the Luther College campus. Riding with him in his car from the airport were Iowa Governor Harald Hughes and Norwegian Vice Counsel Bibi Amundsen of Decorah. The Luther College band played Sousa's Saber and Spurs and Music for the King of Norway as the entourage entered the Luther College campus. Hughes welcomed the king to Iowa, saying, "How joyful we are that you could be with us for this brief visit." Luther College President E.D. Farwell gave the official welcome, reminding the king of Farwell's visit to Norway the previous summer when he had invited the king to visit Decorah. "I bring you greetings from everyone back home in Norway," Olav told the crowd. "May the tradition of cooperation between our peoples remain strong and broad in the minds of us all." King Olav and his party toured the Norwegian American Museum and watched a children's parade before heading back to the airport. King Olav returned to Decorah in 1975 as part of a 26-day tour of the United States during the Norwegian-American sesquicentennial, a celebration of modern Norwegian migration to America. As honorary chairman of the board of the Norwegian-American Museum, known by then as Vesterheim, the king dedicated the restored facility, and he helped lay the cornerstone for the new Center for Faith and Life at Luther College, donating a Norwegian hymnal for the cornerstone. "There are few places in America which take better care of Norwegian heritage in America than this area," he said. The king was 84 when he returned to Decorah in 1987. "He came to renew old ties," the Gazette reported. Norwegian Ambassador Kjell Eliasson noted the United States had as many Norwegian Americans as there were people living in Norway. The king died in January 1991. Decorah residents and Vesterheim officials who knew the Norwegian king say he had a soft spot for this northeast Iowa town, a Gazette reporter wrote. They spoke glowingly of Olav, calling him a man without pretense. Olav's son and successor, King Harald V, and his wife, Queen Sonja, kept the Norway-Decorah connection alive with visits in 1995 and in 2011 in honor of Luther College's sesquicentennial. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, June 19th, 2022. I have selected and read the articles. My name is Sharon Falduto. I am reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org, where we welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.